Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association's podcast entitled Inadmissibility in Employment-Based Cases, Mental Health Issues. I'm J.J. Area, AILA's Education and Resources Associate, and it is my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The speakers have selected some written materials for this podcast, which can be found in your AILA Agora digital library. Go to agora.aila.org and make sure you're signed in. On the top right of the page, you'll see a green button that says My Digital Library. Once on the page for your digital library, you'll see two files. One is the audio file, and right above or below is a resources file. If you have any questions, you can email agora@aila.org. The discussion leader for today's podcast is Laurel Scott from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Joining Laurel is Eric Fleischman from Hartford, Connecticut, and Rocio Woody, a licensed psychotherapist from Atlanta, Georgia. At this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Laurel.
Hi, this is Laurel. So today we are talking about the mental health issues. Now, for the title of the program, it's Inadmissibility in Employment-Based Cases, but when it comes to the mental health issues, it's really the same whether it's employment-based or family-based. There's not really a distinction in how the mental health issues are dealt with or the finding is made. Mental health issues, it makes it, when somebody says those words, I think that it conjures up images of somebody with schizophrenia or severe obsessive compulsive disorder. And while those things are looked for, they're not actually what usually leads to the mental health finding of inadmissibility. That is primarily an alcohol or a drug problem. Now, for the drug problem, any current drug abuse problem is going to make the person inadmissible. For alcohol, it's alcohol abuse that threatens the public safety. So it's mental health that threatens the public safety. These issues are more common than may be commonly believed. The physical and mental disorder ground of inadmissibility in a drug abuser, the number of people found inadmissible on those grounds every year who are applying for an immigrant visa is about the same as the number of people found inadmissible for criminal activity. It's actually around 1,100 for drug and alcohol abuse and around 1,100 for the criminal inadmissibility for people applying for an immigrant visa. So this is a relatively common ground of inadmissibility that attorneys need to know about, even if they're doing the employment-based cases. And that's on the immigrant visa side, but it can also come up on the non-immigrant visa side, even though there's not a standard medical exam, it can still come up. And in fact, there's about 300 people a year found inadmissible who are applying for non-immigrant visas, about 300 found inadmissible for the alcohol problem ground of inadmissibility. And we'll talk more about that in a few minutes. So even if the person is applying for a non-immigrant visa, the attorney still needs to be aware of a lot of the issues involved here. So, Rocio, you're a mental health professional. Why don't you tell us, not really from the legal perspective, but just from a clinical perspective, what is an alcohol abuse or drug abuse problem?
Well, basically, what you have is a spectrum of alcohol use, abuse, and when it comes to addiction up to that point. What you look for in a nutshell is to look for the signs that actually are problematic. And you don't have to be a licensed professional or a certified professional to realize that if you go to a social setting, there will be someone that is drinking, having a cocktail or an alcoholic beverage, and will stop when they need to stop, and someone that will go a little bit further, and someone that actually will not recall having, you know, spend the evening with that environment. So you can see the degrees of alcohol use, abuse, up to addiction. And to me, that when I do presentations for Alcoholics Anonymous, for other groups, I basically say you have to look at five signs, and without having any kind of training, you can do this. Health problems caused by alcohol, and the first health problem caused by alcohol is a hangover. You don't go to a doctor, you don't get diagnosed with hangover, but the very first problem that in a person that is beginning to abuse alcohol is a hangover. Then you have family problems. You're neglecting basic, simple things in the home. I mean, you're spending time with friends, having cocktails, drinking instead of being at home with your family, helping your family, your children, your spouse. Then you have work-related problems, and some people don't realize they have work-related problems because they still have a job. Doesn't mean that you actually are performing to the same capacity that you did in the past or that you are getting the promotions that you should get because of your alcohol problem, and people notice it. And then financial problems, not necessarily that you're actually, you know, spending that much in alcohol per se, but the consequences of going out, clubbing, cab services, consequences of having attorney's fees and other problems related to alcohol use. And then the last, to me, that least in the things that are simple you can determine quickly, is the last is having legal consequences because of your drinking. And people don't think of a DUI or a public intoxication charge, fighting, criminal trespass, all those kind of problems that happen with people when people are already abusing alcohol to a point where you're having all these five type of problems. Then to determine alcoholism or alcohol dependence or addiction, you only have to ask one question. If despite having these five very easily detectable problems, the person continues to use alcohol, that's a high, high risk of the person is already in the early stages of alcoholism.
Okay, so what's the difference? Well, you know, backing up for a second, you mentioned that signs of abuse, a hangover or spending too much money on a night on the town. Now, I think that most of the people listening to this podcast are thinking, well, that's me. I mean, I've had a hangover before. I've spent too much going out with my friends. So it sounds like a really broad definition. Most people have at least one of those things in your list?
Most people either use or have abused alcohol. If the person continues to drink despite being arrested for criminal trespass when you're drunk and you're getting into someone else's apartment instead of yours, I mean, honestly, there is a concern right there, yes. If you get into that, it's a degree, basically, of the problems. The problems can be as easily as having a hangover, and there's nothing else. You don't have cirrhosis of the liver. You don't have any other condition. But what you asked me was, how do we determine if, you know, whether a patient has an alcohol or a drug problem or alcohol problem in this case. And it as you start looking at the problems that the person is having in their life, when you're being arrested because you have a public disorderly conduct while drinking cocktails at a restaurant and you're arrested for that, most likely the person already has a problem.
From what you said, it sounds to me like you're saying, is it fair to say that most people, most Americans perhaps, have abused alcohol on at least one occasion in their adult lives?
I would say most have. I would say most people have abused alcohol at some point in their lives. I mean, through college, through whatever, have abused alcohol at some point in their lives. Most people have. But most people also know when to stop. Most people are not wondering about how they're going to spend the drinking this coming weekend. Or most people can function without having to drink.
So what's the difference between an isolated one or two instances of abuse and someone who's a chronic abuser and has a problem and someone who's actually addicted?
Well, chronic abuse leads to addiction. You can use alcohol for your entire life and not having to become an abuser. You don't have to go to the next step. Now, I didn't think that it was going to be such in depth, but there's genetic predisposition. There's other factors that will actually influence whether you move to the next level or not. But basically, you can use alcohol for your entire life and never become an abuser, never become an alcoholic. And you can still have a cocktail, a glass of wine, a beer, your entire life until, you know. So the next step is abuse. And you say that many instances of abuse, yes, you can abuse alcohol, especially during the younger years and when you have less responsibilities in your life and you're going to school. You may abuse alcohol a few times in your lifetime, you know, maybe several times or many times in your lifetime, and not necessarily move to alcohol dependence.
Now, what about drugs? What about marijuana? Is it very similar to things like marijuana in terms of abuse and addiction?
It's not the same. I mean, and I think we're getting to to a different level of complication when you're talking about illegal drugs, and it's not illegal in every state of the United States. So honestly, I prefer to stick to one topic instead of, you know, just going to the legality of it, because when you're actually saying marijuana, then you go to all other illegal drugs as well. So is cocaine okay? Is heroin okay? It's not... okay. Backtracking. No, it's not the same. Because you depart from the legality of it. The way, at least as a professional and years of experience that I have, we start with, if you're using alcohol, you're still within the legal boundaries of the law. None of your immigration cases or any other cases in your life or your career will be affected if you have one glass too many today and there are no legal consequences to it. But if you're just smoking marijuana, let's say in the state of Georgia where I am, and you're caught, whether because there was a raid or whatever was the reason why you were caught, your career and your entire life is at risk. And you're making
okay,
those choices.
Well, let's talk about how these problems might endanger others. Now, obviously, if the alcohol causes you to strike another person, you know, you're endangering other people. But are there other ways in which a drug or alcohol problem can maybe indirectly endanger the public safety?
Well, it begins at home, really. I mean, and the cases that we see are cases that, of course, come from the legal problems that people have had. I mean, all kinds of cases, from domestic violence to criminal trespass to public intoxication to sexual harassment, all kinds of cases. But it really, from a clinical perspective, it's not just from the legal angle, but it begins at home. I mean, the example you said to your children, and if there is a genetic predisposition, then you have the environmental issue, the environment that the children are being raised in addition to the genetic predisposition. So the children have twice a risk of actually becoming alcohol abusers, at least at some point in their lives.
Okay, thanks, Rocio. So, Eric, can you tell me a little bit about how the determination of alcohol abuse or drug abuse is made for immigrants?
Sure. And before we turn to that, I just wanted to make one point. We were just talking about the difference, for example, between alcohol issues and drug issues. And the point I'd like to make is that I want to remind people that they need to always look at the definitions of Class A versus Class B medical conditions. And the three different basic types of Class A medical conditions are, first of all, a communicable disease of public health significance under the regulations. Secondly, a present or past physical or mental disorder with associated harmful behavior or harmful behavior that's likely to recur. And alcohol abuse could be considered to fall under that category if it's likely or has caused harmful consequences. And then the third prong is drug abuse or addiction, and that's where we have a major distinction, because while some states have currently authorized the use of marijuana, it's still listed federally as a prohibited substance, and therefore use of marijuana could just be considered a Class A medical condition if you're considered to be an abuser or an addict, even of marijuana, even in the state of Colorado, that I think that could well still be considered a Class A medical condition.
Where are you getting this Class A, Class B from?
Well, that is the definition in the regulations, the distinctions between the types of medical issues. Class B are other physical or mental issues or disabilities, which may not be a significant departure from normal health. So those are situations where there may be a need for treatment or there may be the need for public support. And so Class B issues are ones which typically raise the public charge grounds. The question, does this person need financial support? Is it possible that the government would need to support them? So that's where it may lead to a grounds of inadmissibility, whereas the Class A are straight out grounds of inadmissibility.
Where are these Class A and Class B? Where are they described in detail?
A good place to look is the Immigration Service Policy Manual, It has all this laid out. Volume 8, Part B, specifically talks about Class A and Class B and their impact on admissibility.
They're also described in the CDC technical instructions for civil surgeons and CDC technical instructions for panel physicians, which are actually two different manuals. But all of that goes into a lot of detail in those CDC instructions.
That's right. That's right. And so anyone listening to this who needs to review these, it's pretty much all available online now. So if someone goes into the policy manual, those pages then have links to the technical manual as well, the technical instructions.
So, Eric, can you tell me really who is making the finding of inadmissibility if you're applying for a visa? Who makes the finding if you're applying for adjustment of status? Like, procedurally, how does it work?
Sure, sure. So, first of all, I thought we'd just draw a quick distinction between the non-immigrant visas and then the immigrant visas. Because increasingly, this is now coming up in the non-immigrant context, especially on the issue of DWIs. So the first way that any of these issues could come up is in the application forms themselves that someone's submitting. So when someone is doing an application for a non-immigrant visa, they've now got to do the DS-160, the online application. And that has specific questions that address these issues. Do you have a mental or physical disorder that poses or is likely to pose a threat to the safety or welfare of yourself or others? And then another question, are you or have you ever been a drug abuser or addict? And then they also ask, have you ever violated any law related to controlled substances? And then finally, have you ever been arrested or convicted for any offense or crime? So between those four questions on the non-immigrant visas, if, for example, you've been stopped for a DWI, that you probably have to answer yes and give explanations. And in the same way, when you're applying for the immigrant visa, these questions do come up in the basic application forms. When you're applying for consular processing of the immigrant visa, there's a specific question of whether you have a physical or mental disorder or if you are a drug abuser or addict. And then on the 485, when you're applying in the United States, also there's a similar question on the 485. Have you ever been arrested, charged, indicted, convicted for any law excluding traffic violations? So there are questions right in the forms that potentially raise the question. But going back to the non-immigrant visa, the consular officers are increasingly looking at this issue. It is raised in the FAM. So if you have had even a single DUI arrest in the past 5 years, the FAM at 9 FAM 41.108, note 1.1.
Okay, I got to stop you right there. The FAM has actually just been updated, so
okay,
all of the
right.
citations have changed. So it's now 9 FAM 302.2-7B3B. Go ahead,
great.
I'm sorry.
Good. No, that's excellent. And so what it does say, though, is that where there's been even a single alcohol-related arrest or conviction in the last 5 years, the consular officer must refer the applicant to a panel physician. So that's a pretty strict test, you know, any DUI in the last 5 years. Also, it says...
Conviction?
Arrest or conviction.
Mm-hmm. So you can have somebody who doesn't have a conviction and it was actually dismissed, and they're still going to get caught by this.
That's right. That's right. So... Mm-hmm. It's a place where good screening of your client is a really important tool. Each attorney does things a little differently. I know many attorneys just let the clients do the DS-160 on their own. But if you do that, that's fine, but you also want to make it very clear to them that if they spot an issue, if they're going to answer yes to one of these questions, like they've been arrested or they've had even, you know, any DUI-related issue, that they should talk to you in advance. Because it then becomes a good question of whether they're going to want to go to the consulate. I think generally consulates now are denying visas in situations where someone has had a DUI arrest within the last year, and in some cases even within the last 2 years. So what that means is if your client thinks it's not a problem, I had a DUI, but I had a good attorney and the charges were dropped, for example, well, if it was fairly recent, they're going to really want to consider if they're going to want to go to a consulate and get that visa. So if, for example, they've recently been approved for an extension of H-1B status for a full 3 years, and then they're saying, well, I just want to go home for a vacation and I'll just get my visa at the consulate, you really need to warn them that it might not be so easy. They might go to the consulate and then actually be denied the visa and stuck outside the U.S. for maybe a year or more until the consulate thinks that they're no longer ineligible for a visa. Because remember, again, this is a potential Class A medical condition which renders them inadmissible because it's not a drug issue, but it's considered a disorder of some kind which has potentially harmful behavior, namely that you could be drunk and hit someone with your car and cause serious injury. So I've seen cases where people, upon finding this, decided to cancel their trips, and if they've got the H-1B extension, to just stay in the U.S. and not risk being stuck abroad.
Who actually makes the finding of inadmissibility, the consular officer or the panel physician?
Well, in that case, the process is that the consular officer would spot the issue, then they send the applicant to the panel physician. The panel physician would write up the report, which would suggest that there's a Class A condition related to the alcohol abuse. They would come back to the consular officer, and the consular officer would be the one to deny the visa, but it would be based upon that medical finding. And, of course, since it's all happening outside the U.S., your chances of success of overturning a determination like that are quite low. By contrast, and we'll talk about this more, when you're in a process that's inside the United States, you have more opportunities for appeal and review.
Let me just throw something in there. It is the panel physician who determines that the person has a mental health problem that threatens the public safety. And once the panel physician makes that finding, the consular officer must find the person inadmissible on that ground. So technically it's the consular officer making the finding of inadmissibility, but really he has to make that finding after the panel physician finds that the person has this medical condition. So even though technically it's the consular officer making the finding of inadmissibility, it is effectively the panel physician that's making the decision.
That's a good point, because it's true. It is a medical issue, and mm-hmm. It's the medical professional who's making the determination itself.
And that's significant, because if you need to overturn the decision, the consular officer's hands are tied. So throwing a zillion things of information at the consular officer really isn't going to do that much, because his hands are tied. I'm sorry, right. Go ahead.
Right. All right, and then just to turn to the immigrant visa process, as we mentioned, the issue can come up in the basic application form. That's one place it could be identified. But, of course, even more likely is the medical exam itself. For people in the U.S., they are going to the civil surgeon and getting the I-693 completed by the doctor. And one of the questions there is are there any Class A or Class B medical conditions? And as part of the screening, the doctor would be asking questions about drug use or abuse, medical issues that could be associated with harmful behavior. And I think you'll be talking about that more, but it's a question of being prepared for those questions. And then along the same lines, when they're applying for an immigrant visa abroad, it's a slightly different medical exam report, the DS-2053, and there it's being done with a panel physician. One big distinction people should be aware of is that when it's done abroad through the consulate, consulates will often schedule the medical exam the same day as the immigrant visa interview. So, for example, in London, they might schedule someone to go to the medical exam in the morning and then go to the consulate in the afternoon. And if all goes well, that's fine because the medical report could be sealed up and sent over to the consulate, and you could be finished with your whole process that same day. Challenge is if it doesn't go well and there's something in that report that suggests you're not admissible, then you're really you're at a loss. There's not much that can be done. By contrast, when you're in the United States and you're applying for adjustment of status, these things can be done in stages, which is to say, stage one could be that the beneficiary goes directly to their own doctor and has their own medical report, gets their vaccination records, and gets some input from their doctor of whether there are any issues that they might foresee. Stage two, go to the formal exam with a civil surgeon and have them complete the 693. And here's where we have some opportunity. When they go to the civil surgeon, they can request the sealed envelope, which can be submitted with the adjustment of status, as well as a complete copy for their own records, and they can share it with you, the attorney, to look over, and you can see whether the doctor has suggested that there is a grounds of inadmissibility.
And you bring up a great point there, because I think that that's one of the key differences between consular processing and doing an adjustment of status, is that when you do the consular processing, a lot of the panel physicians, they're not going to cooperate if you ask for a copy of the medical exam. You can ask, and some of them may give it to you. And even if you see it and you see that there's going to be a problem, I don't think you can stop it from being sent over to the consulate. So you see it, you see there's a problem, and it's already too late. But if you're doing an adjustment of status, you get a copy of the medical exam, and you see, and you can't open the one that's in the sealed envelope, but you get a copy of it. You see that there's a problem, then you say, let's stop for a minute, not hand this in, see if we can go to a different civil surgeon and get a different opinion, because not everybody agrees. So you might actually have an opportunity to doctor shop and find one who doesn't think that you're a drug abuser or an alcohol abuser. And so that's one of the key differences. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think you're right, because there are gray areas here, mm-hmm. especially where you've got any situation that does not involve a controlled substance. In the CDC technical instructions, they have a chart which shows whether something is likely to be a Class A or Class B issue. And anything that's pretty much any issue that's involving use or abuse of controlled substances, whether it's abuse or use of the substance itself or a disorder that's related to the use of the controlled substance, will typically be leading to a Class A situation. However, if it's not involving a controlled substance, so if it is something like alcohol, your odds of something being found a Class B disorder, which does not necessarily have associated harmful behavior, is much greater. So I agree.
Let's stop for a second. Let's ask Rocio this question. Rocio, do you think that it's fair to say that sometimes competent experts may disagree on whether somebody's an alcohol abuser?
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Thank you, Rocio. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah. So given that experts can disagree, it's absolutely a good idea to try to spot these issues in advance, see if you can make your case that maybe that there was some issue in the past, but it is not an issue which currently would be associated with some sort of behavior that could cause harm to others. Because if that's the if that's the fact, then you may have just a Class B disorder, which is not a grounds of inadmissibility.
Eric, can you tell me what happens? Let's say that, you know, you're going to get stuck with this finding. Let's say somebody, it happened at the consulate, and the panel physician already sent their decision over to the consulate, and it's an adverse decision that you think is wrong. What can you do about it?
Yeah, I'm not really sure that there's a lot you can do when you're in the hands of the consulate, because remember, too, when you're consular processing, your beneficiary is outside the United States, so they're stuck. If they're found to have grounds of inadmissibility, they're not going to be able to come back to the U.S. By contrast, if you've got someone in the U.S. and you've got an issue, first of all, they're here, and so that takes a little bit of the pressure off. And then also there is a specific method for reexamination, which is basically the process is a review board can be set up with three medical officers, at least one of whom has experience in diagnosis and treatment of the disease for which the medical issue has been found. And they can.
I want to give a citation because this is a lesser known process. In fact, I think most attorneys have not heard of this process. It is found at 42 CFR 34.8. Again, that's 42 CFR 34.8. And it is a process for challenging the finding of the civil surgeon. It's not a waiver. It's a process for overturning the decision. Go on.
That's right. And as part of this process, it's not a very long section. As part of the process, it specifically says that the alien may, at their own cost, introduce witnesses before the board. And within its discretion, the panel of three can listen to these witnesses, which can offer evidence to explain that this is not a condition that should be considered Class A.
Let's talk, let's bring, if you don't mind, Rocio back in on, let's say you convene this board, and now you're going to be presenting evidence to this medical review board to prove that somebody is not doesn't have an alcohol problem that threatens the public safety, or that their drug problem is actually in remission. So, Rocio, what sort of things should be presented to that medical review board?
We have here, at least in Georgia, we practice with DUI offenders and multiple DUI offenders as well. U.S. citizens are here in Georgia. And in order for them to get their license back, especially for a multiple DUI offender, we have to present certain evidence to the state of Georgia driver services to be able to actually support the license reinstatement. So it's a similar type of situation where you have to present testimony from as much supportive evidence that your findings is not just something that you're saying, that this person told you that they have made a lifetime change. We have to look for the signs of that. So a relapse prevention plan will be something that is ongoing and the person is actually practicing. Evidence of lifestyle changes, you know, things that are different from what it used to be. Evidence of substance abuse treatment, inpatient, outpatient. In the past, they have completed substance abuse treatment. They have actually participated in ongoing treatment after an inpatient hospitalization, evidence of access to support groups. They are actually on ongoing mental health. They have access to a mental health professional that they can continue to see if they have any kind of problems. And also support from family members. What kind of social support system, family support system this person has, religious organizations, affiliations, community and civic organizations, things that the person is doing that were completely different from what they used to do. I mean, I had a case where this person had come when he was 17 years old. He had three DUIs from 17 to the age of 22. Now he's 42, and over the past 20 years, the lifestyle changes this person has made are incredible and extremely evident. So they actually, and this was actually a citizenship case where the citizenship was being denied because of the past three DUIs.
Now, I've had some clients where when I wanted to prove that they no longer had the problem that they used to have, and I asked them what's different, then sometimes they said, well, I was really stressed out when this bad stuff happened. And just from a layman's perspective, my question is, well, what happens the next time you get stressed out? So is that one of the things you take into consideration, or is not just, you know, less stressed now than before, but that they're actually dealing with stress better?
Exactly, that they have a plan. What is the plan to prevent the same thing happening again? And also evidence of lifestyle changes. We're talking about an addiction problem doesn't happen overnight. So there has to be steps where the person has taken steps to show evidence of lifestyle changes. In this case, this person, you know, started a soccer league. I mean, there were so many wonderful changes. The entire family appeared before the immigration judge here in Atlanta. So it was so evident and clear that this person had made lifestyle changes over the past 20 years. So it has to be clear, and the state of Georgia actually, when it comes to U.S. citizens for DUI cases, they require certain things, and we go through the same process and more, because this is obviously something extremely important for the families.
Now, for drugs, where you need to show a year of remission, some attorneys have asked me in the past if their attorneys have to have drug tests at certain intervals for a year before they can overcome this, and if so, what intervals? And I'm wondering, Rocio, do you feel, just from a clinical perspective, if that's necessary for you to overturn a previous finding?
Well, it's part of it. No, it couldn't be just that. And also, when you have a drug test, you have to make sure that a drug test is admissible, especially for court purposes. It's admissible. It's something that there's a chain custody, all these kind of things. But basically, it will be a part of it, not just because the person is testing negative every so often. And is this random testing? Is the person that is actually in a system where they will get a number and then they call on a daily basis and they're randomly tested? Or is something that this individual is going every so often? And also depending on the drug of choice. If it's an addiction to cocaine, for instance, you know, they're going to go when they know they're clean. And it's so many factors that you have to look into, and it couldn't be the only factor.
Do you think that it's a necessary part of it? Like, if you have somebody who's coming in now and the finding has been made, and do they have to go through this year before they can get the finding overturned? Or can you look at other evidence?
Mm-hmm. My apologies. I think it would help. I don't think it's absolutely necessary, but I think you, as an attorney, you will want to do everything or advise your client everything possible to help the case. So I think that would help.
Eric, is it a legal requirement?
I'm not sure it's a legal requirement. You raise a good point about the one-year issue, but for example, if you look at the rules for the reexamination, the key is the issue of whether, in fact, there's a Class A or a Class B condition. And the Class A condition is an active, someone, for example, in the case of drug abuse, whether they're actively a drug abuser. And I think that's always something of a judgment call that has to be made based on the facts.
Here's what it says in the CDC technical manual for panel physicians. It says, when a panel physician defers diagnosis and classification, the panel physician should explain to the applicant what the panel physician would like to see during the next 3 to 6 months to show abstinence. This may include, but is not limited to, requiring clinical reports from healthcare professionals for applicants with possible substance-related disorders to demonstrate participation in a drug treatment program. For applicants with deferred diagnosis and classification, the panel physician should consider documenting in a statement signed by the applicant the information he or she is providing to the applicant. The statement should specify what is required during the next 3 to 6 months to show abstinence. The panel physician should also consider requiring clinical reports from healthcare professionals for applicants with possible substance-related disorders to demonstrate participation in a drug treatment program. Now, what that says is they're making suggestions to the panel physician, but there's no hard and fast requirement, and there's also no indication that even if you did all of this, that the decision would be overturned. So there's no hard and fast legal requirement that the drug testing or even drug treatment be done. It's a suggestion, but it's, ultimately it's going to be up to the mental health professional in question.
Right. And I agree. And in the CDC manual, it also even says specifically that random screening for drugs is not part of the routine medical exam. So there's a lot of areas where there's some discretion that can be applied.
Right. And Rocio brings up a good point about the chain of custody. So when you have somebody who's abroad and they want to do, you know, they want to get the decision overturned in a year and they want to show it with random screening or with just any kind of drug test, there's a big issue of, well, where do they go to get the testing done? What's going to be trusted by the panel physician? And if the panel physician doesn't tell them, which often they don't, then it's not clear, even if they get this testing done, that it's going to be recognized by the panel physician. Okay. Rocio, can you tell me a little bit about, I know that you've done some of this in court. Now, this is an important thing to consider because, you know, we just described the reexamination review board for an administrative adjustment of status case, but sometimes an adjustment of status is in court and you could have somebody with this drug abuse or alcohol abuse finding made in court and then you'd be presenting the information there. So are there any differences for what would happen in court compared to what you've already told us?
Not really. Everything basically is to show evidence of the finding, the diagnosis that you are making that this person is actually, they had a problem in the past and the substance abuse is in remission. In remission proving that, you know, they have actually actively been involved in the recovery.
Mm-hmm. What about the person swearing up and down that they haven't been using drugs or alcohol? Is that going to be enough?
That's not enough. That is not enough.
Got to go beyond that. Eric, what would you suggest in terms of getting a testimony from family members or, you know, is testimony from family members not going to be useful because they have a bias? You know, what kind of witnesses would you suggest getting to try to overturn a decision?
Yeah, probably the best would be professionals because I think they carry the most weight. But other supporting documentation can be useful as well. I think that might be considered facts upon which some of the professional opinions could be based. So if, for example, a family member says that I can attest that this person has been living at home and has not been drinking or has not been using any substances, you know, that could be good evidence. Just also to remind people, too, when we talk about substances, the list of federally prohibited substances is an important consideration because, for example, if someone has a drug abuse problem but it involves some sort of drug that, let's say, is over-the-counter or so obscure that it hasn't even made it to any list of federally prohibited substances, that would not be considered technically a drug issue. Rather, it would be a potential mental health issue. But for all of these things, I think testimony of people who know the facts can be useful.
Okay, let me talk a little bit about you know, what happens at the consulate. I think I'm going to take over this section. This is probably what I have the most experience with. There have been a lot of reports from attorneys of disagreement over the panel physician findings. There have not been as many reports of disagreement over the civil surgeon's finding. So while this does happen sometimes where the civil surgeon is going to make a finding of mental health disorder or drug addiction not in remission that you disagree with, that's going to be unusual for somebody adjusting status. It happens much more often of people applying at the consulate. And one of the the problems with that is, as Eric alluded to earlier, there's really no process for challenging it. There's a process for challenging it in an adjustment of status if the person is here. There isn't one for challenging it when the person is at the consulate abroad, and that's because of the doctrine of consular non-reviewability. The only process for trying to get a medical finding overturned is for the consular officer to do an advisory opinion request with the CDC. And that is only going to happen when the consular officer disagrees with the panel physician's finding. And this is one of the reasons why it becomes very clear that the consular officer's hands are tied if he disagrees with the finding. He can't overturn it himself. He has to go to the CDC. And while there's no statistics available, some people working at the consulate have privately told me that the CDC never overturns the medical officer's finding. In fact, a couple of years ago, the immigrant visa chief down in Mexico, not the one who's there now, told me that he had personally done 3 advisory opinion requests with the CDC where he thought the finding was wrong, and the CDC didn't overturn any of them. So even though there is a process, it's not a good process, if you will. And also, as I said, only the consular officer can do that advisory opinion request. The applicant cannot, the attorney cannot. It has to be the consular officer. And if he says, no, there's no point, I'm not even going to try, you can't force him to do it. So if he doesn't feel like doing it because it never works, it's not going to happen. So essentially, the panel physician's finding is going to stand even if you disagree with it, even if you think it doesn't comply with the CDC technical manual. And for that reason, it is very important to watch out for this. And keep in mind that for the alcohol abuser ground of inadmissibility, what's going to end up getting them in that review is if they have any alcohol-related arrest in the past 5 years or 2 in the past 10, and it doesn't have to be a conviction. So I did have a case where I had a client who was applying for a non-immigrant business-based visa, and he'd had a DUI arrest in the United States that was dismissed, and there was no breathalyzer, and there was no blood test, and there was nothing to indicate that there was any alcohol used except for the police officer claiming that he smelled alcohol in the person's breath. It was never confirmed in any of the data. And yet, the panel physician still found, based on that arrest alone, that the person was inadmissible as an alcohol abuser. So in my legal opinion, that doesn't comply with the CDC technical manual or anything that we know about how the findings should be made, and yet there it is. And there's been a lot of reports from attorneys, and there was actually an AILA advisory on this a number of years ago, of very consistent reports from attorneys stating that if there's any alcohol-related arrest within the past 2 years, the panel physician in Mexico will find the person inadmissible on this ground. And that can be very frustrating because it doesn't really have, in my opinion, enough basis in law. Once that finding is made, you're stuck. If the person is abroad, for the reasons that I stated, for drug abuse, there's no waiver. Either the person is in remission or they're not. If they're in remission, they're not inadmissible and don't need a waiver. If they're not in remission, there's no waiver available. So you either have to prove remission, and the guideline is 1 year without use, but it's up to the panel physician. For the alcohol, if the person is inadmissible, there is a waiver available, but it is very, very hard to get. For the immigrant visa, the person can file an I-601 and go through the standard I-601 process for this medical problem. And the procedure is basically the same as for any medical ground of inadmissibility. The person has to prove that they are going to go into treatment after arrival in the U.S. They have to get a letter from that treatment facility stating that they'll take them, and they have to prove how they're going to pay for that treatment. And then also they have to get that facility to agree to report to the Department of Public Health in that area. So it's actually rather complicated and expensive because they're going to have to prove they have treatment. And it can be a little frustrating for somebody that you don't feel has an alcohol problem has to agree to go get to turn themselves into an alcohol treatment facility and pay for it after they come to the U.S. But that is the process. I think for most of your clients, it's going to be better just to wait out that 2 years. It depends on the situation. But for a lot of them, that's probably the best recommendation. For a non-immigrant visa, the process is a little different because there's a non-immigrant waiver under D3 for the alcohol and also for the drug problem. And the person would go through the standard D3 waiver procedure, which for most of the world except Canada is going to involve just asking the consular officer, tell them that you want to apply for the waiver, and they'll either recommend or not recommend, and they'll send that to the admissibility review office. Those are rarely approved for B visas or for F visas. You're going to get probably a higher approval rate for the employment-based visas, and you know, there may be disagreement on that. There's not a lot of statistics available that I can cite to you, unfortunately, but that's something to consider. So for most of the clients, it's going to be better just to wait it out. I think the best way to deal with this issue, and Eric, chime in if you agree with me, is to weed these cases out at the consultation. And if you think that the person is going to have a finding of inadmissibility on the mental health issue, probably the best thing to do is to tell them to wait until their drug problem is in remission or until it's been at least 2 years since the last alcohol-related arrest.
I agree with that.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with that because I think you're absolutely right. So many of these inadmissibility issues that we're talking about are time-sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
If you spot that there's a history, you can advise the client, look, you need to clean up your act. We need to let some time go by, and you need to be able to document that this is no longer an issue, and maybe let 1 or 2 years go by where you've carefully documented that there's no issue anymore. And you can resolve the problem just in that way by letting time pass and making sure that your client understands that they shouldn't get involved with the issue or substance at all.
I agree. I mean, yeah, these are time sensitive, and the effective expiration is 1 year for the drugs and 2 years for the alcohol. So just wait it out. Now, that's not an absolute statutory expiration. It is going to be up to the panel physician, but for most cases, after a year since the last reported drug use or 2 years since the last alcohol-related arrest, you're in a much better position than if it's less than that year or less than 2 years.
And I have something to add to that.
Mm-hmm.
I think just not a matter of time, and which just makes perfect sense to put what both of you are saying in the legal aspect of it, but also to be able to prove that you have actually made lifestyle changes during those 2 years or 1 year that you need to wait. If the person is just waiting for a time and there's no evidence of changes, other than the word saying, oh, I waited 2 years and for the past 2 years I haven't had a drink, I mean, that's not going to be helpful.
I think for that, it depends on whether you're adjusting status or going to the consulate abroad. The panel physicians are resistant to accepting additional evidence from the applicant. I'm not going to say they'll never accept it. And some attorneys have had some success contacting the panel physicians directly. But in my experience, the panel physicians don't like to deal with the attorneys, and they don't like looking at a lot of documentation. And there's very little the attorney can do to compel them to consider it or to get any kind of proof that the doctor did look at it. It's very different if you're going through an adjustment of status in the U.S. and you have this option for the to convene a panel and have it reviewed, then you have this effective appeal that's not available when you're going to the consulate abroad. So I've talked to attorneys who've said, you know, it looks like this person might have the alcohol problem, ground of inadmissibility, but I'm collecting a lot of evidence to give to the consulate, and I sort of shake my head and say, you got to wait out the 2 years, and then you know, it's great that you have that evidence, take it with you, but doctor's probably not going to look at it. You can give it to him, but he might not look at it, and there's no way to tell whether he did or not. So mostly I would wait it out. But I would also give this other advice to the attorneys. if you have a client with any arrests at all in their history, you need to read the police reports. Because even if the crime in question doesn't have an alcohol or drug element to it, there can still be mention in the police report of alcohol or drugs, and then it becomes an alcohol or drug-related arrest. And probably one of the big examples there is going to be domestic violence. If there's mention in the police report that the police officer thought that the accused was using alcohol, that is going to be considered an alcohol-related arrest. And even if the charges are dismissed, then it's going to cause them problems on the mental health grounds of inadmissibility. So the attorneys, absolutely, if your client has any arrests, you got to read the police report and see if there's any mention of it, even if it wasn't substantiated with any kind of drug or alcohol test. Eric, do you have something to add for that?
No, I agree with that completely, because the police reports have all sorts of information that won't make its way to any other documents. And you'll often have a case where someone will have also, in many cases, they will try to get the charges dropped or even the records expunged. But again, for these purposes, remember back to the application forms that people are submitting, the question often is, have you ever had an arrest for any type of issue or even a charge? Mm-hmm. So the fact that they've had a lawyer maybe expunge their records doesn't mean that there wasn't an arrest for alcohol abuse or it involved alcohol abuse. And digging behind and finding those records is important, because a good consular officer could ask questions that could bring out the evidence, and it's much better to know in advance what your issue is.
Absolutely, absolutely. And my other big piece of advice for attorneys would be that to prepare their clients for the medical exam. Now, I know we all think that it should be sort of obvious. Don't take drugs before the exam. It's always, you know, put your hand on your head or your forehead whenever a client tests positive in drug tests. But just warn them about the types of questions that are going to be asked in the medical exam, and to be prepared for that. Now, you can never counsel your client to say something that's not true. But what you can do is tell them, look, they're going to ask you about prior drug use. They're, you know, even if they run a test, which is actually not a standard part of the medical exam, even if they run a drug test, it's only going back a few days. If you report that you have used drugs in the past, you are very likely to be found inadmissible. Now, I can't counsel you to say anything that's not true, but there's the information. Most of the people who are found inadmissible for the drug ground of inadmissibility, the only evidence or that's used is the applicant's own statements, especially during the medical exam. So even though these questions are asked on the DS-160 and the DS-260, it's really the medical exam where they come up, and the attorney is not with the client at that moment. So a lot of this really does come down to preparing your client before they go to the medical exam. And one of the things I've learned through things that have happened is when I have a dual representation where I'm doing husband and wife, and I've mostly been communicating with the U.S. citizen before they go to the medical exam, before they go to the consular interview, I have got to talk to the applicant, even if it's through an interpreter. You know, not everybody speaks Spanish, and explain this to them directly, because sometimes husband and wife don't communicate, and USC husband doesn't know that his wife plans to answer yes to that question. So you know, I'm telling him, and it's not, the message isn't getting to her, and he's not going to be there during her medical. So it's imperative to speak directly to the applicant before the medical exam and warn them about this issue and advise them as best as you ethically can. Eric, do you have comments on that?
No, I totally agree. Because I think the biggest challenge people have is being surprised, and plus being nervous. If they're not prepared for one of these exams, not prepared for the types of questions that might come up, they might be nervous. They might start jumping around and saying things that they might not have to say. important thing for them to remember is just listen carefully to what you're being asked and give answers directly to those questions. It's not up to an individual to be offering all sorts of information that's not asked, and they should just be comfortable listening and answering truthfully.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, people are most likely to blurt out something negative if they're surprised by the question. So they need to know that these questions are going to come up. JJ, I think we are coming up upon the end of our 60 minutes. Rocio or Eric, do you have anything to add before we wrap this up?
I'd just like to thank both of you. I think this has been very helpful, and I'm hoping that it'll help all of our listeners be prepared as these issues come up.
I also like to do the same. Thank you. The work that you do, these people are people that I work with on a daily basis, and they put their lives and their families' lives in your hands, and we all appreciate it from the immigrant community.
Well, that's sweet. One more thing I would add before we turn it back over to JJ is I also, just to make sure that I don't forget to talk to the client about this, I have standardized messages that I send the client before they go to a medical exam, and it's on there so I can be sure I don't forget to tell them about this. And then also in my standard contract, there's a line about things can go wrong at the consulate, and you need to know that before you go abroad. I don't want you going abroad thinking that it's risk-free. There is a risk. I can minimize it, but I can't eliminate it. And I want them to understand that before they give me any money. If they're not willing to take that risk that I cannot completely bring down to zero, then I don't want them to give me money. So that's on my contract, and I would recommend that to attorneys as well. JJ?
Okay, great. Thanks, Laurel. For those of you who will be seeking CLE credit for your participation in this podcast, please make note of the following four-digit attendance verification code. The four-digit code is 8577. Again, the code is 8577. Please visit AILA's Web CLE Center at www.ailawebcle.org to record your CLE credit. Thank you very much to all of our speakers for sharing their knowledge and expertise, and to you for joining us today. That concludes our podcast.